You are listening to Investing Matters, brought to you in association with London South East. This is the show that provides informative, educational, and entertaining content from the world of investing. We do not give advice, so please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to this Investing Matters podcast. My name is Peter Higgins. You can find me at Conquers3 on Twitter. Today, I have the huge privilege of speaking with Gabriel Boyle, the Investment Director, Head of Research at Troy Asset Management. Gabriel is responsible for Troy's global equity strategy, is the co-manager of Trojan Global Equity Fund, which for those of you who are unaware has outperformed Nick Train's Linsall Train Global Equity Fund on a total returns base over the past 10 years. Gabriel is also the fund manager of the Electric and General Investment Fund with 33 years investment experience. Gabriel, thank you ever so much for joining me. You know, you've been an absolute huge success. It's fantastic to actually get you on the Investing Matters podcast with me.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me, Peter. Thank you. Pleasure.
And thank you also again for joining me initially for the Investing Matters All-Star Investing Panel that we held at the UK Investor Show in June of this year.
Yeah, that was great. Very good thank event. Very well organised, busy, lots of people. Seems like a long time ago now.
It does. Summers have seemed to have flown by. It does indeed. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Now, I want to start this conversation with you, Gabriel, by discussing your starting life. University College Dublin, gaining a BA in History and Economics and going on to gain a Master's degree in Economics. What triggered your earliest sort of interest in economics?
Well, that's a very good question. I grew up in Dublin. One of five kids, went to UCD when I was 17, so quite young. In Ireland, the system at UCD is you get quite a broad education. So you start with three subjects, then you go down to two for joint honours. And so I really enjoyed economics. And I spent my summers when I was at university, back in those days, Ireland wasn't the booming economy it is today. So most of our students wanted to get out in the summer, and I came to London and temped, basically. I learned to type and I temped, and I worked in all sorts of jobs in the city. And so I worked in Goldman Sachs was the first place I went to. Then I worked at fund management businesses. I worked at Citi. I worked all over the place. And I just loved it. I loved the whole sort of vibe of London back then in the late 80s. It was really, you know, booming. I was good at economics and I liked it. So I did a master's. I applied for loads of jobs and ended up in London, which was a pretty common sort of route for Irish students back then.
Fantastic. I love the fact that you said that you came over on your holidays to work in London and actually got the bug there. And, from the late 80s to the 90s, you haven't lost it because you're still here working and doing it so brilliantly. So your first ever role in the city, what was that?
So I started, I was very fortunate. So my kids are at this stage now where they're, you know, university and applying for jobs. And I always tell them, you know, you just have to keep, I probably sent literally hundreds of applications and I was offered three jobs, one of which was in investment management. I didn't know very much about it, but I was incredibly lucky in that I went to work for a company called Royal Insurance Asset Management, which was the asset management arm of the Royal Insurance Company. And I worked on the European team, which was it was fantastic. It was a fascinating time. The wall had come down in 1989 in Germany. Continental Europe was dealing with the kind of aftermath of Germany absorbing the West Germany absorbing East Germany and all of the consequences of that. And actually, by the time I started the markets, they were dealing with the kind of fallout of it. So it was a challenging time, but a really, really interesting time. And you know, Europe was starting to kind of adopt much more kind of Anglo-Saxon style ways of thinking. American investment banks were crawling all over companies, IPOs were happening, governments were selling off assets and all of that. And so I worked in the European team there for 3 years, and then joined Lazard 3 years later. So it was I worked with really good people, and I was very fortunate to have that grounding. I spent time in, before I went to the European team, I worked on in fixed income, worked on US equities, Japanese equities, UK equities. So it was a great training. We don't probably do enough of that today with our young people. But I, it meant that you got a good grounding in the fundamentals of bond markets and all the rest of it. So yeah, good start.
Fantastic start. You mentioned the fact that you did so many different roles and got engaged in so many different things. So, like you say, it's fantastic that you got that level of exposure. And after that, you moved on to Lazard Asset Management for where you were for 17 years, and you attained the position of Senior Managing Director, of which you were responsible for global and European portfolios. Please, can you share with our listeners your greatest lessons from that period of 17 years at Lazard's, please?
Oh well, I mean, I've been incredibly lucky in my career to do this job. It's a it's a fascinating, fun, challenging, never boring, constantly. You meet all sorts of amazing people, and Lazard was a microcosm of that. Some really bright people from all over the world, and I was fortunate. I started in London, but I spent a lot of time in the US. I did Europe for a long time, but then I broadened out to do initially World ex US, and then so I was investing in Japan and Asia and emerging markets. Then in, moved to do global, so worked alongside my US colleagues. So it was a great learning experience, and great worked with great people, and was incredibly formative in my kind of investment approach, which is one of being wanting to be really very discerning in owning great businesses, not paying too much for them, and holding on to them for a long time. So really thinking long term, really understanding the power of, that the wonderful power of compounding. And I learned the hard way. I mean, really the hard way, that there's a big difference between investing in great businesses and investing in less than good businesses. We were in those days, we used to call ourselves relative value, and investing in Europe and Asia and Japan in those days, would you could get caught in all sorts of value traps of businesses which you might think are one thing, and then discover that actually the corporate governance is terrible. The disclosures weren't what they are today, and it could be a minefield. So it was very formative in my investment approach, which is one of really wanting to be incredibly discerning, and try and own really great businesses, and that you can have the confidence that you're going to own for the long term.
Thank you for that reply. I appreciate the fact you touched on value traps there. I'm going to talk about those a bit later on, and the fact that there's always more to learn regarding the markets. The markets are always changing and evolving, and therefore that's what you've done clearly, because you've been such a success. Now, briefly after Lazard, you were at Newsmith Capital Partners. You just touch on that, because was that a hedge fund, if I'm right in understanding it?
So I left Lazard in 2010, having been there for 17 years, and I had a brief interlude where I joined some former Lazard colleagues, Simon Roberts, who very sadly died last year, and Neil Baker,
I'm sorry.
and it was a very brief time. I had a very long non-compete from Lazard when I left, because I'd been there a long time. Which was basically a year, and joined Newsmith for a short period. But in that time, I met Sebastian Lyon and Francis Brooke from Troy Asset Management, and it felt like sort of coming home, really. I was very, very lucky to meet them, and I knew that was the right place to be. So I came to Troy, which has been fantastic for me, and a wonderful experience.
And as you mentioned that you met Sebastian and Francis And then you joined late November 2011, I believe. And you were given control of the what was then the £59 million Trojan Capital Fund from Sebastian and Francis. Please can you share with our listeners an overview of Troy Asset Management, its size, scale, number of funds, if possible, and essentially Troy's overall investment philosophy, please.
Yeah, so Troy started life in 2000, originally set up by Sebastian Lyon and Lord Weinstock, really to manage the assets of the Weinstock family. The history of Arnold Weinstock was that he managed GEC through their sort of heyday of industrial conglomerates in the UK, very and all, had a tremendous reputation for managing it in a very prudent and disciplined manner. He retired in the early to mid-90s and then had the misfortune to sort of witness the demise of GEC, which turned into Marconi and ultimately went bankrupt. So by the time he and Sebastian got together, he really, both of them wanted to, they wanted to do something different. It was at the time when, you know, we were coming off the TMT bubble, the technology mania of the late 90s. And the objective really was to manage money in a sensible, long-term, with a clean eye on capital preservation. You know, very influenced by the sort of thinking and teaching of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, and just invest very, very sensibly for the long term, and without regard for the fashions of the day, you know, or benchmarks or all of that sort of thing. And Sebastian, and then with Francis Brooke, built a very successful business in Troy Asset Management, which today is just under £14 billion. And we have four key strategies: a multi-asset, which is the flagship business of Troy, UK income, global income, which is managed by my colleague James Harries. Blake Hutchins runs the Trojan Income Fund strategy today, and then global equities. But so when I joined in 2011, it was really part of a sort of effort by Sebastian and Francis to increasingly invest outside of the UK. I mean, they'd always invested in the US, and were always very open-minded in their perspective, but I think they recognized very sensibly that it made a lot of sense to kind of increase that effort and to invest more actively, particularly in Europe and the United States, and that's what we've gone on to do. So we took that fund, what was the Trojan Capital Fund, which in those days was predominantly Weinstock money with some other outside capital, to turn it into a global equity strategy, essentially. But one which is very consistent. It's obviously fully invested in equity, so it's different to our multi-asset strategies, but it's consistent in that we look to invest in really strong businesses that are growing, that are well managed, that have strong corporate governance, that generate a lot of cash and can reinvest those cash flows at high rates of return, and where we don't want to pay too much for them. And it's managed in a concentrated way, again, which is consistent with our other strategies. So we currently have 28 holdings in the fund, and that's you know, the turnover is very low. Again, that's consistent across our strategies at Troy. We tend to want to own companies for a long time.
Thank you for that response. I'm going to go and concentrate and focus on your global equity fund in a second. I wanted to ask you, firstly, though, as head of research, you and your leadership team have faced many unprecedented events in recent times. Numerous leaders of the UK government, different chancellors, rapidly rising interest rates, soaring inflation, and also a war in the Ukraine. How would you say you and the Troy leadership team have navigated this high period of uncertainty thus far?
Well, it has certainly been very challenging and pretty dramatic period of time. I mean, we're very lucky in for a few things. Firstly, that we're a pretty seasoned team, so we've been through a lot. We've been managing money. I mean, Sebastian and I, particularly, who are a bit older than the rest of them, and Francis obviously as well. We manage money through the, I said I started in Europe in the early 90s. That was a time when interest rates in the UK, I think they were 15% there or thereabouts when I started. So we've seen what it's like to have very high interest rates and how dramatic and profound that can be on the impact of it on economies. We went through the technology mania. I was managing money through 9/11, and spent time in New York at that period, which was extremely stressful. We went through the financial crisis, which that was a serious existential threat at every level. So we've been through a lot, and that I think is really comes into its own through the kind of events that we've lived through over the past few years of COVID, and so on. As a business overall, through COVID, we managed that, I mean, I think incredibly well. We're very lucky in that we've got a really strong team, both in the investment team, but also in the infrastructure around us at Troy, which has been fantastic. So we've invested a huge amount in the technology, for example, which allowed us to seamlessly not just work from home, but also trade and manage money through that period in it without a missing a beat. From more fundamentally from an investment standpoint, our whole sort of raison d'être at Troy is about being prepared for the unexpected, if you like. We know bad things can happen, and that's why we invest the way we do. And we consciously look to invest in businesses that, and from an equity point of view, that are going to be okay, even in much more difficult macroeconomic environments. We invest in companies that have pricing power, companies that sell stuff which is fundamental to our lives, companies that have got independent forces at work which are driving them structurally. So, for example, digital payments is something which is almost a multi-generational force that it's is at work. And because we seek not to overpay, that also gives us a sense of a defensiveness to the way in which we invest. And in a multi-asset context, we have other strings to our bow, which allows us to navigate through very difficult times. So it's kind of in our DNA that we are prepared for difficult times. It doesn't mean that it isn't very challenging, and it isn't very from a sort of emotional perspective, if you like, it's extremely stressful. But working in a good team where you have a very clear sense of what you're aiming to do, and a clear investment philosophy and a sense of priorities, gives you amazing kind of strength, and frankly can be quite liberating when everyone else around you is slightly floundering.
Yeah, I love the way that you've responded to that question. I think it's essential. You've touched on there the experience of the team and the fact that as a team you've been there, seen it, done it, and experienced the good and bad times of the markets, and it makes you as a team more resilient and adaptable. But you also touched on the importance of being prepared. The markets are in their very nature uncertain, and being prepared for the good and the bad periods. And choosing higher quality stocks that can be forming during difficult times is important. Now, I want to touch on one stock that you hold in both your portfolios, and that's Alphabet. And it would appear that there's been a series of events over the past decade or so where everybody says, Microsoft are going to come after them with Bing, mobile search is going to kill it, social media platforms are going to reduce search. Voice search is going to reduce their availability for revenue. TikTok even is going to, usurp them. And now we've got AI. What are the pillars of Alphabet that make it such a long-term bedrock investment for you and the Troy Asset Management team?
So we invested in Alphabet at Troy in 2013, and I had been an investor in it when at Lazard. In fact, we were investors shortly after it came to the market back in 2005. It is an extraordinary business. So when we invested in it initially, it was because everybody was concerned about the impact of mobile and the fact that people wouldn't that if they were looking at an ad, it would be more difficult on mobile. It would be margin dilutive. They wouldn't make as much money out of it. That we'd all be using apps rather than using search, and that therefore the advertising revenue would be negatively impacted, et cetera, et cetera. And there were a number of other controversies as well. But it was very clear to us then, and it still continues to be the case, that this is an amazing franchise. It's incredibly strong, and that that core search functionality and the sort of strength that they have accrued by the investment in that over now many, many years gives them talk about barriers to entry. I mean, it is amazing, and it's a great example of why you want to invest in really strong businesses that have these the ability to invest their very strong cash flows at good rates of return, but they are investing, big chunks of their revenue and capital expenditure and R&D consistently. And we love businesses that do that, because, here we are now 10 years later, and our investment case on Alphabet back in the day wasn't about artificial intelligence, although they were already starting to get involved with DeepMind. But it just shows you that when you've got a really wonderful business that's investing, they're innovating, they're kind of entrepreneurial, and other things come through, and we've got multiple examples of that in the companies that we own in the portfolios, where they kind of are nurturing or growing little small businesses that become big oak trees, if you like, over the long term. And Alphabet is an example of that. And so through the time that we've owned it, as you say, there've been multiple controversies, and yet, over that time, the revenues of the business have gone from about 60 odd billion dollars to these days just shy of 300 billion. So, it's incredible what they have achieved over that time. The earnings have increased from about $1 a share to about $5 a share. There, I mean, these are general numbers, but it just gives you a sense of that incredible power of compounding. And so, if you can find these special businesses that do something unique, but also have that capacity to reinvest in themselves, that's a really powerful combination. And what's been amazing with Alphabet is that these controversies have just given us amazing opportunities to buy more, frankly, and it's one of the reasons why the shares have they haven't really ever traded. People always talk about FANGs and the overvaluation and all this sort of stuff. Actually, Alphabet has traded pretty consistently at a valuation lower than a lot of consumer staples businesses, despite the fact that it's grown, way, way higher than that in terms of revenue growth over that time. So it's an intriguing company, and there are obviously always controversies in their aspects of it which aren't very attractive, but ultimately it's a money printing machine, which is interesting.
Thank you for that response. I think it's a fantastic company. I think it's got more to come, as they say. There's lots going on there. What I find brilliant about the fact that you and your team have held it for so long is that the Trojan Global Equity Fund has outperformed Nick Train's Linsell Train Global Equity over the period of 10 years, from July 2013 to July 2023. It's been, I think tech has been part of that, but I think also it's been about finding of quality companies. Would you agree with that, Gabriel?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, one of the things that we obsess about is that we want to own really resilient businesses, but we also want to own adaptable companies. And that adaptability component is, in our mind, absolutely fundamental. I mean, people talk about tech almost as if it's a sort of new phenomenon in our lives as investors. The reality is that technology and its impact on commerce and our lives has been a dominant theme throughout my career, and I'm sure will continue to be for many, many more years to come. And so owning businesses that have that recognize that, embrace it, and adapt accordingly is, to my mind, absolutely fundamental. And so we, you know, historically we would have been very comfortable to stay within the zone of consumer staples businesses, you know, serve maybe healthcare, where, you know, we know they're selling goods and services which are used every single day, and we can understand the products and so on. But actually, if you think about it, we sort of think about technology as tech staples. They are, you know, once you are using Microsoft, once you're a customer of Microsoft, whether it's now 365 or back in the day, using Office, you're in. You know, you're in, and that will continue to be the case. You know, we invested into it. Once you're using QuickBooks, or you're using Intuit's TurboTax to fill in your tax return, you know, the chances are you're going to continue as a customer. And so we've always taken the view we need that adaptability. And it's one of the reasons why when we look at the sort of characteristics of the portfolio in aggregate, we have very high rates of spending in terms of capex to sales, R&D to sales, is way higher than the average company in the index, and we continue to do that. And where we see companies pulling back from that, we worry. We really worry. And where we see companies not embracing that change, and where there are too many sacred cows, we worry. And I think it's something that we are you know, proud about it, Troy, is that we have embraced that, and it is more challenging. It's difficult. You know, sometimes these companies are big, they're dynamic, they're changing, their life cycle is potentially shorter than that of some of historical sort of staples companies. But nonetheless, you've got to understand them, you've got to embrace them, you've got to know them, and it's been a tremendous opportunity for us and our clients over many years now.
Thank you. Now, I want to touch on a company you only bought recently, back in July. You made a small purchase in New Holding, a UK-listed information services provider, RELX. And I believe that fulfills all the criteria that you spoke about reinvesting and being innovative and adapting to what's going on in the world. And I just thought it was really, really good because they're making recent advancements in it regarding AI as well. So can you tell us a bit more about that and how the team came to identifying RELX?
Yeah, so RELX is a company that we have known for, you know, many years. It's been held in our UK income strategy for a long time, and we've owned it in the past, actually, in the fund, and it's a great example of a tremendous success note. A tremendous success in the UK market, and it kind of came to our attention in for the global equity fund, because like a lot of companies in the UK, the valuation we felt was very compelling relative to what the financial productivity of the business and all of the good stuff that's going on in the company. And so we've kind of admired it from afar, if you like, in recent years. And we felt the valuation gave us an opportunity. It's an example of so many of the things that I was talking about earlier, where the company have evolved with the digitization of data. And they've managed to sort of reinforce their amazing competitive position despite all of the challenges that have come with that digitization, and reinvested in the franchise and continue to do so. And again, there've been over the years numerous times where people have felt that the franchise would be challenged, and in fact they've managed to prevail. But it's been a bit like Experian, actually, where again it's one where they've embraced that adaptability, they've embraced the challenges that come from technology to reinforce the franchise.
Thank you for that. I want to ask now if you can give us an overview, slightly different fund that you manage, the Electric and General investment fund, because it's got a slightly different mandate. Could you just tell us a little bit about that, an overview of it, please?
Yeah, so the Electric and General Investment Fund, we've been managing for a number of years now, and actually we run it alongside the Global Equity Fund in a very, very similar way. The Electric and General used to be, interestingly, used to be an investment trust. It was one of the oldest investment trusts in the country back in the day, and it made the decision in, I can't remember exactly when it was, maybe around 2011, to turn it into an open-ended fund, which was a shame because actually it was one of the few global equity investment trusts in the UK. But and we were appointed to manage it back in 2015, and yeah, it's a really lovely fund that, you know, sort of gets forgotten about in the context of an incredibly competitive and aggressive sort of global equity sector. But you know, we're delighted to have it in our stable.
Yeah, it's a fact, and it's done phenomenally well for you as well. And you, like you say, you own similar sort of stocks within that. But I wanted you to share with us one stock you hold in that particular fund that most of our listeners, that I think, will not be aware of, and I'll also share the characteristics of it. And that name is Fiserv, one of the global leaders in fintech and payments. Because what I note as well is that Troy Asset Management don't invest in banks, so it's really good to see that you got some fintechs and some payments companies within that.
Yeah, so again, Fiserv is a company we've owned in the fund for both funds for a long time. I think we, again, it probably was 2013, if not earlier than that. It is, again, you know, it's evolved quite a lot from when we first bought it. They merged with First Data, and it is, we have a number of companies in the fund that are exposed to digital payments, essentially, and Fiserv is an example of that to an extent. It's slightly different in that it's more old tech than new tech, but they are an outsourced provider for the banking system in the US, where the banking system in the US is an extraordinary thing in that you have these huge banks like JP Morgan, but then you have the multiple thousands actually of thrift banks and smaller regional banks, which would use the services of Fiserv to help them with digital banking, etc. And Fiserv have also moved much more actively into digital payments. They have a number of products in that space which have been incredibly successful, one of which is Clover. So it's an interesting company because part of the growth in earnings that have come from Fiserv has been through really pretty aggressive cost management. It's managed in a pretty tight way. They've been a very active and quite aggressive purchaser of their own stock over the years, which has also been quite a powerful part of the kind of return that we've made. The shares have continued consistently to trade on pretty low valuation. So, I mean, for example, at the moment they're trading on about mid-teens forward-looking PE, this isn't the most perfect business in the world, but they've done a lot of really good things and continue to do really good things, and so we would argue that valuation is on the low side. And it's been a fabulous investment for us over many years now. So it isn't a company that would be well known to everybody. It's a $72 billion market cap business now, so it's not small. It's not small at all. And actually, we probably all use their products in ways that we wouldn't be aware that Fiserv are in that chain, you know, when you're tapping your credit card to pay for a cup of coffee or whatever. So it's a really interesting business.
Brilliant. Yeah, I didn't know much about it myself up until a few weeks back. So yeah, it's one for listeners to definitely go and research. Now, Gabriel, the 10-year total returns performance for the Electric and General Investment Fund has been outstanding, circa 177% over the past 10 years. What pleases you most about the long-term performance of this particular fund?
Well, I mean, for me, it's all about delivering returns for investors, and we're, well, I mean, I'm an investor, obviously in both funds, and so it's really matters to me. But it does matter an awful lot for the underlying investors, of many of whom I know quite well, and they're interested in, they're obviously interested in capital preservation, but they're also interested in the return. They need they that many of them will. If they need capital, sell a few units, to live off, and it's an important, at the end of the day, we're in this job to look after our investors' capital, which, frankly, is a massive privilege, but and a massive responsibility. So for me, that's what it's all about, and that's particularly the case for Electric in general, because it's a small fund, and it's one which is very close to our hearts.
Thank you. I want to touch now on a quote from Troy Asset Management's founder, Sebastian Lyon. It recently quoted legendary investor Jeremy Grantham saying, "Volatility is a symptom that people have no idea of the underlying value." You showed steely fortitude and stuck with Meta, formerly known as Facebook, when the shares hit an 8-year low back in November 2022. Of around $88 per share, when many other fund managers had already exited Meta after questioning their continued investment potential. What did you and your team identify that gave you such conviction to hold on, as you were obviously richly rewarded as Meta's shares rallied since to a 52-week high of $326 per share just last month?
Well, that was a stressful period, I can tell you. That's a great example of where, it was a stressful one. But so why did we hold on? How did we get through that? Why did we add to it? Not quite at the lows, but not far short of it. I think that Meta is an example of why working in a firm like Troy is a really good place to manage money, because this is a job where you are so easily distracted. You are it's such an emotional, psychological challenge every day. And working in a firm where you're given the time to think, to do your homework, to do your research, to really get into the weeds, and to take a step back and take a breath. We have one of, people talk about the, what's your competitive advantage? And you can talk about, oh, well, we do better work, and we do more detailed work, and we have better access, and all this. Actually, the biggest competitive advantage we have is that of time and being able to take a breath and having a clear idea of what you're looking for. And so we did so much work on Meta. We analyzed it to the nth degree. But I think one of the biggest things was that being able to take a step back and be objective, because it's such an emotive company. I mean, honestly, we didn't do a single meeting with anybody where that wasn't the first thing they wanted to talk about. And just being able to step back and look at it as a business that is highly financially productive. In the same breath as people were, as George, my colleague, likes to say, were hate selling, they're using WhatsApp, they're on Instagram, their kids are using Facebook to advertise their local business that they've set up, and so on and so on. And so, the services are were being there were a whole host of factors behind what was challenging Meta, the post-pandemic kind of fallout, the investments that they were, there's some of the crazy metaverse stuff, the challenges that from Apple and IDFA, a whole host of different factors going on, But ultimately, despite all of that, Meta generating lots of cash, generating lots of returns, and actually still underlying growing, etc. But I would say that one of the biggest things is that's an example of where being in the right, being in a small team with a very clear investment philosophy, and the time to take a breath and focus is it comes into its own.
Thank you. I love the fact you've touched on time, objectivity, and having a small team there, and all getting around the table and disagreeing at times, and to then get to a point of consensus where you go, you know what, we'll stick with this, and you've been rewarded accordingly with that. I think it's fantastic when teams do that. So I'm going to slide straight into another point here, the complete opposite of that now, how teams tend to fall for the fragility of some of the meme stocks, mania stocks, and hype stocks as well, which you guys have navigated so brilliantly. You know, we've seen so many fund managers fall for the likes of Zoom, Beyond Meat, Peloton, and WeWorks. How do you guys ensure that you avoid those fragilities?
Well, we're never going to be immune, but you know, we have a very high hurdle rate, essentially. So the process that we undergo when we're looking at a company, so we'll start off by doing what we call a work in progress note, which is to sort of sketch out the investment case. We'll discuss that as a team, decide if it's worthy of further work. We'll then go away and do the work. That could take really quite a long time and do quite a lot of detailed analysis where we'll meet with the company, meet with perhaps competitors, you know, customers, et cetera, and get a full sense of what they're about. We'll discuss it as a team, decide if it's appropriate. It'll go into our investment universe and then potentially we will decide to invest. The valuation has to be right. But, you know, we're really looking for businesses which generate very high returns consistently over a long period of time, where they have got those competitive advantages in a whole host of different ways. We want to understand the management, how they're incentivized, what their history of capital allocation has been. You know, how are they motivated? What's their incentive structure like? We love businesses where there is still a family or a founder or investor, when we have confidence that they're going to act as long-term investors, and we don't want to pay too much for it. And so that whole sort of list of factors means we look at an awful lot of stuff that doesn't make the cut. So, but we at the same time, we want to balance it between being very discerning, but also not being too close-minded. And it goes back to this point I was saying earlier about adaptability. So we do want to look at new things and keep on doing that research. So it's a balance, and we will look at things, we'll miss things, and we will pass on things that will perhaps do very well. But again, I think as well, we try not to have that, you know, FOMO of fear of missing out, but balance it at the same time as. You know, the other thing which is important to say is that we have a process whereby when a stock moves a lot very quickly, we'll review it, we'll write up the notes, we will get an alert from our risk team which is saying this has had a big fall, what's going on. We try and have that healthy self-critical process where we kind of will look through, well, what are the mistakes, what can we learn from this, how can we do this better next time? And I think that's a really, and being very honest about that is an important part of being an investor. You know, you're not going to get it right. I mean, the stats are that you're doing well if you're getting it right 60% of the time, which means you're getting it wrong 40% of the time, and how you deal with the getting it wrong bit is as important. And I know that sounds a bit trite, but it really is. So you know, we're not going to get it right all the time, and we just have to be honest about that.
Love that response, thank you. Now I want to touch on what's been happening year to date regarding the markets, if I may. They say the narrower the stock market leadership, the less healthy the stock market. With just seven stocks, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Tesla accounting for over 77% of the US stock market performance in the first half of 2023. What are yours and Troy's asset management's outlook regarding the potential health of the UK and the US markets over the next 6 to say 12 months?
I mean, look, we are definitely in a challenging period. We've, as you said earlier on, we've had a re-emergence of inflation, significant and dramatic move in interest rates, the biggest we've most of us have seen in our and fastest we've seen in our careers. Most people operating in financial markets have not lived with this kind of an environment ever, particularly. We haven't seen it in the US in our careers, so this is different. And so that brings with it all sorts of fragilities. When you have rises in interest rates and rises in the cost of borrowing at a time that following on from a period of very, very low interest rates for a very extended period of time, inevitably there are going to be accidents, and there will be, and it'll be messy, and we know that. And so in our multi-asset strategies that Sebastian manages with the team, they are very much in batten down the hatches mode, and have been for some time now. From a fully invested equity perspective, it comes back to what I said earlier, that we really want to own very strong businesses that can navigate through what's likely to be a very pretty tough macroeconomic backdrop. But we do as investors deal with a lot of exogenous forces which are not always rational, and that can be anything from the activities in ETFs and lack of liquidity in certain parts of the market and so on, that definitely do create this sort of weirdness that we're probably seeing at the moment. And again, it just comes back to this point that you've just got to have your wits about you and try and use that volatility to your advantage. So one of the things that we are very, George and I are very conscious of, is that when we are trading, when we are active, is to try to be incredibly price sensitive. And because you do get this volatility and you do get these big moves, and you want to be buying when you're on the upside and selling, and that sounds really obvious, but you've got to be very mindful of it. And so we look periodically to see, look at our sort of trading activity and assess, have we added value? And we want to be adding value. We don't trade very much, but when we do, we want to be very price sensitive. And so yeah, it definitely feels choppy and perhaps more dangerous than we've seen for quite a long time. To be honest, we've had every year, it feels like this past few years has been dangerous,
It's
but
much longer,
yeah,
indeed.
it's definitely been stressful and probably will continue to be.
Thank you. Well, that runs seamlessly to my next question, really, regarding all of what you've just said. How do you maintain your focus? Because they say, that focus is the bridge towards intention and accomplishment. How do you maintain it? Because it must be so difficult.
Yeah, it is. I think one of the things about this job, being an investor, is that it never leaves you. You live it. I mean, you really do. And it's a wonderful job, but it's also it's never done. And you we read a tremendous amount, and reading is a gift. I've got four kids, so that keeps me pretty busy. And I've said this many times, but I really do believe it. Like the expression, you're only as happy as your least happy child. Investing is a bit like that. You're only as happy as whatever your least the whatever whatever. There's always something to worry about,
Yes.
and but you've just got to, we try and do lots of exercise. That helps. We've actually got an investment team gym session today. That's a good distraction. But I think reading, listening, we listen to a lot of podcasts, and we discuss a lot as a team. We all of these things. But it's also that fact that if you work with a group of people where you've got a very clear idea of what you want to do, it helps to just keep you sane. I think you know where you're going, you have a plan, that helps to kind of cut through some of the intense noise that we live with. But yeah, so that's the way I think about it.
No, I love that reply. Thank you ever so much. You've touched on the fact you've got four children. Have they expressed an interest in investing, or ESG or ethical environmental issues? Where are they at?
They are all interested in investing, and I try to instill in them that the power of compounding works. The earlier you start investing, the more that compounding is going to work for you. And I tell them that all the time. They take the mickey out of me about it because I bang on about it.
But you're right.
I know I am right. My eldest daughter is actually. She now works in the music industry, so that's a different tack. But she does invest. My next one is just starting his career, and we'll see where he ends up. But they're a bit, and the other ones are too young yet. My husband is a doctor, so he has a different way of spending his life. And I think maybe the younger ones might follow him more than me. But I think they'll all continue to be interested in investing and interested in the world around them.
Excellent. I'm really pleased to hear that. Now, you touched on, I think you might have answered this already, about your investing side of it. And obviously you're quite well invested with regards to investing in Troy. Tell us a little bit about your own personal investment strategy. Is it all in regarding Troy, asset management and the funds, etc.? Or do you have some external things that you do?
So I, from an investment point of view, I am invested in the funds that I manage and the funds that we manage at Troy, and we value that alignment of interest as being absolutely fundamental with our investors, and we have structures in place from a remuneration perspective for Troy, which encourages that and indeed insists on that. For me, I'm all in that regard, and have been and will continue to be, and consider that to be absolutely fundamental, frankly. But in terms of sort of investing time wise, one of the things that we do encourage at Troy is for people to have outside business interests. So I'm involved with two charities. I'm a trustee of Launch It, which is a charity that helps young people from tougher parts of town to start businesses, and that is, it's a fantastic charity that really gives young people an opportunity to be independent and have a different life. And and I'm also involved in a rural charity which was bunch of us set up, which is something which is very close to my heart. And I'm on the board of Witten Investment Trust, which is a great, a wonderful role where I get to meet other managers. And that gives me a fascinating perspective on the world. And that's, again, it's something that a number of my colleagues will also have other outside business interests, which we encourage and, we think is helpful if you want to be a rounded investor. So from a financial point of view, all in on Troy and aligned with our investors. But from a sort of from a time point of view, we think it's very important to. One of the things we do at Troy is we give a substantial amount of money as a percentage of our revenues to charity every year. And that we have a charity committee which allocates those funds. And we try to give the money to charities where we can have great confidence they make an impact. So small charities that are we take a similar approach to the way we do investing in businesses, small charities where the money goes directly to the causes and is something that where, we really feel confident that we can make an impact. But it involves all the employees at Troy, and that's been something that we're particularly proud of.
Fantastic. I love that you're doing that. I'm an ambassador for a charity, so I know exactly what you mean by putting money and time into charities where the money goes directly to the actual users of that particular charity. So very, very well done. I wonder if you could just expand briefly, though, on the charity game, Girls Are Investors, for us, please. I think that's really one that I really want to hear much more about. And I think people would like to know about as well.
Yes. So GAIN is a fabulous charity. It was set up by one of my colleagues, Charlotte Young, and with some other people to really try and address the fact that There is a massive underrepresentation of females in the investing community, and that female, the young women don't always think about investing as a career, and don't necessarily even think about investing, frankly. And you know, you look at the stats around ISAs and SIPs and so on. You know, there's the female representation is way below where it should be. And so GAIN do an amazing thing. They go into schools, they go into universities, and they talk to girls and young women to get them interested in investing, particularly as a career, and try and sort of break those boundaries and assumptions that you've got to be really good at maths if you want to do investing, or that that it's a really sort of testosterone-led career. And it's a fabulous thing, because we, you know, there's a lot of work being done about the fact that actually women make very good investors, because they tend to
Better
be
investors,
patient.
Absolutely
I mean,
agree.
Willis Towers Watson did a study which actually demonstrated that they were women led, and female participation teams did better on average. But you know, regardless of that, we're good at this, and we want girls to think about it, and we want, at the very least, for them to take an active responsibility for investing, even if they're working in other careers. And GAIN do a brilliant job of that, and they run an internship program, which takes, so speaking from the point of view of being an employer at Troy, they take away a huge amount of the pain of managing internships, which is a wonderful thing. And so we were one of the Troy were one of the founding sponsors of it when Tilly Franklin and Charlotte Young set it up, and we're really proud of that. But we continue to support them in a very active way, and we have an internship program. In fact, we have somebody here as an intern at the moment who's come through that, and it's fantastic, and it's spread like wildfire. I went to their awards earlier in the summer, and it's amazing to see all these young, enthusiastic women really, you know, pushing on in their careers. And I hadn't, you know, I wish there'd been more of that through my career. It's kind of been a bit of a sadness, really, that a lot of my female colleagues have left the industry over the years, and we miss them.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, it's fantastic that you were all doing that piece of work. Now, I've covered all of my questions bar one. I didn't know if there's anything that you wanted to share that you feel I haven't covered that you'd love to share regarding Troy before I go to my very final question.
I think we've covered a lot. I think you've covered a
We
lot.
have.
Thank you. Yeah, I think hopefully we've got that message across.
Thank you ever so much. Right, I'm going to give you my final question now, if I may, Gabriel. I have one final question for you. And if you were granted the complete autonomy and power to change one thing globally for the betterment of the whole human race, what would that be and why, Gabriel?
Well, gosh, that's a big question. I think I would have to, and you know, I'm not. That's a very big question. I mean, the one that comes to mind immediately is child poverty, but it's an impossible thing to fix. But I think issues around children and children's lives, and some kids having it so difficult, is something that is extremely close to my heart. So I would have to say that, but an impossible thing to achieve.
That's a worthy cause there, but thank you ever so much for that reply.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. That was great.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Gabriel Boyle, Investment Director, Head of Research at Troy Asset Management, and a fund manager, also one of the most successful women that we have in the city. So please give this a very, very good and lengthy lesson to be learned from. Gabriel, thank you ever so much for joining me. It's been an absolute
thank you,
pleasure
Peter.
Having you on the Investing Matters podcast today.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to Investing Matters. Be sure to check out the London South East website for free tools and info to research your next investment. You can also join in the conversation on our social media channels. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more content, including our CEO interviews. Catch you next time.